The Senate Human Services Committee will come to order. It's 1:30 on April 19th. Thank you all for being flexible with the time. I think you all know it's Suicide Awareness Day. We're having an event out in front, and if you get a chance to walk outside, it's pretty stunning. There are 762 empty chairs sitting on the Capitol Mall, representing the 762 people who died as a result of suicide in 2015. And that is a crisis that hits all ages. We lose a 10 to 22-year-old about once every 10 days in Oregon, pretty consistently, giving us one of the highest youth suicide rates in the nation. So we have a lot of work to do in that area. But we today get to talk about something much more uplifting. I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2216A. Senator Matt.
Senator Matt.
All right, congratulations. Yeah.
It's easier than I thought. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2216A establishes specified rights for foster children, and it directs the Department of Human Services to adopt rules establishing the Oregon Foster Children Siblings Bill of Rights. It directs DHS to review the rules periodically and promote participation of current and former foster children in developing the rules.
And youth, too, right? Children and youth?
And youth.
Awesome. Senator...
Yeah. Me too.
Everybody's a senator today. Representative Peluso.
Thank you, Chair Lupe. Madam Chair. You're here by me. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm here today to urge your support for House Bill 2216, the foster sibling, foster youth.
Representative Peluso, after all that, you have to say who you are.
I do, don't I? Okay.
Yeah.
My name is Carla Peluso, proudly represent House District 50, the city of Gresham. And I am here today to urge your support for House Bill 2216, the Foster Youth Sibling Bill of Rights. Youth from the Oregon Foster Youth Connection came up with this concept at their annual conference and later brought it to me. They identified this bill as their highest priority for the 2017 session. When a child or teenager is removed from their family and placed into the foster care system, they are confronted with many life changes all at once. They meet their new foster parents, go to sleep in a new bed, and often have to move schools. For a young person, this is very daunting. The positive presence of siblings is often the stability that keeps a youth thriving in the face of very difficult life challenges. At times, youth are separated from their siblings, become a placement together, just isn't available. When this happens, there's no guarantee that the youth's need to maintain contact will be respected. That's why I am asking you to support this bill. House Bill 2216 establishes the Oregon Foster Youth Sibling Bill of Rights. These rights include maintaining contact and visits with siblings, including contact by telephone or electronic device, being provided with transportation to visit siblings, training foster parents and caseworkers on the importance of sibling relationships, developing a contact plan, and being immediately notified of placement changes or catastrophic events affecting them or a sibling. Please feel free to direct any questions you have to the Oregon Foster Youth Connection, who will testify shortly. They know what they're talking about. Maintaining contact with siblings is critical to stability and positive development for our foster youth. This bill helps us to ensure that they can find comfort and support with their siblings in very difficult times. I strongly urge your support.
Thank you so much. Any questions for Representative Peluso?
Just thank you for bringing this.
Yeah. My pleasure, and thanks to all these folks.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for being patient with the schedule change.
No problem. Thanks.
All right, Alexis Baska and Lupe Rankin. Very good to see you both.
Hello, Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lupe Rankin, and I'm here today with Oregon Foster Youth Connections. Oregon Foster Youth Connections is a program for Children First for Oregon. We are a group of current and former foster youth who plan to change Oregon's foster care system through advocacy, activism, and leadership. So HB 2216, the Sibling Bill of Rights, blossomed at OFYC's 2016 Policy Conference, where 31 current and former foster youth dove into the touch problems DHS caseworkers, foster youth, and foster parents are experiencing in Oregon at this time. On July 19th of 2016, many of us presented multiple recommendations to an audience of lawmakers, administrators, and service providers. Of the 7 policy suggestions, OFYC members chose sibling connection as the top priority to bringing forward to legislation, legislative session. And I'm going to hand it over to Lex.
Hello. For the record, my name is Alexis Baska. Thank you for having us, Chair Gelser and members of the committee. I strongly support this bill because I think that it would have been super helpful in my case. Being separated from your siblings is probably the most awful thing that I've ever had to experience. I entered the foster care system when I was 15. And I am now 20 years old. So my father had just passed away. My mom was unstable, so I really looked upon my sisters to be a constant person in my life, but I was separated from them, and it was awful. I'm the oldest, so something that was always drilled into my head is that you take care of your little sisters, like you be their protector, and to not have any contact with them or be with them every day was way worse than entering into the foster care system or anything that I would endure during the foster care system, being in the foster care system. You just have that maternal instinct. You just want to be there for their first dance or when they start to have crushes and be that support in their life. So to not be able to cause more trauma, I became very depressed and hopeless because I couldn't be around my sisters. So I think that if I would have been placed with my sisters or even had a contact plan, it would have made a huge difference. I would have a better relationship with them today, I think.
Well, thank you very much. Are there any questions for...
Do we have anyone else?
We do not have anybody
okay,
else.
So I do have a question.
Very good.
So if something happened where your bill, if this passes and everything's right here, and someone then, one of the foster care parents does not follow through, is there a complaint process? Is there a way that this can be reported, and who would you report it to so that there could be repercussions?
I personally don't. Chair Senator Gelser, Senator Menez Anderson.
You're doing great.
I don't know what the specific repercussions would be. I would imagine that we could talk to our foster care ombudsman. You can talk to your
attorney or the supervisor or the caseworker.
Okay.
Any follow-up questions? Nope. Any other questions? Well, thank you. And your organization has done such a great job of bringing people to the Capitol, really telling stories. I think the policy summit that you had last summer, just the organization of getting your bill written and finding a fantastic champion in Representative Peluso, you are some of the most effective advocates in the building, and it's really great to get to have you in the committee and to get to see your bill move along. We're not posted for a work session today, but we will post it sometime next week and get it off the floor and off to Governor Brown so we can get it signed.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Senator Brown?
Madam Chair, actually, I'm wondering if someone from the department could come up and talk to us about how they might implement this.
Would that be, Kevin, are you willing
Great.
To come up? Thank you. Thank you both very much.
Yeah, thanks, Kevin. I'm sorry to put you on the spot, but I'm just wondering, you know, what you see as the next steps for this once I assume we're going to pass this. It's a great bill. And how the department would implement it to make it so.
So certainly, Chair Gelser, members of the committee, my name is Kevin George, and I manage the Foster Care and Youth Transitions Program at Department of Human Services. So many of the conversations we've already had with the folks of Oregon Foster Youth Connection have really been about how we implemented the Foster Care Bill of Rights a few years ago. Mm-hmm. And so it's about getting together a group of folks from their organization who are interested in the sibling bill and start working on exactly what this is going to look like, both in the language that we use, because there's a few things in the bill that actually says this is what the Bill of Rights will include, but that doesn't mean it's limited to that. So then we'll put in things such as, great question, about what happens, what is the complaint process if this doesn't occur, how much sibling contact, you know, is appropriate or whatnot. So I think it is one of those that we'll work with the Oregon Foster Youth Connection on putting it together and then get it out to everybody over the next several months. We had the conversation in March about starting a small group, and I've already invited a couple of the Oregon Foster Youth Connection members to participate in our training that we already have for caseworkers about sibling, the importance of siblings, so they can actually sit in and listen to the training and then start giving us advice on what else we need to change about that. So we've already kind of actively started moving in this direction.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. I have a question. Yes. So right now, when siblings... Are siblings all over the state? I mean, are they placed all over the state, or do they try to concentrate them in an area, or is it just depends on, just depends?
Yeah. Senator Gelser and Senator Mona Sanderson, absolutely, it is across the state. And there are situations where I, quite frankly, stand fairly proud of what we do for siblings, sibling connections and keeping kids together, much higher rate than many other states do, because that has been a value of ours for some time. But there are situations where times where it may be that Johnny needs to move to a different setting instead of his sister. And sometimes the conversation is about, well, why does Johnny have to move to another setting? It may be that he has higher needs that this provider can't provide. So one of the things we're talking about right now with our subcommittee as a result of our federal audit for placement stability is to say, what if we bring those services to the setting rather than having Johnny go to the setting? So is that one of those things to say, grandma's able to take in both kids, but what she's going to need is some other support, so bring those people to that home so Johnny doesn't have to leave. That's one thing. The other thing that I know is very clear for us is that we have those situations just in family dynamics now where two children may come into foster care as a result of something that was occurring within the family. They may have two different fathers. Both fathers may get their child, so the siblings are not together. So those situations occur. There's a variety of scenarios, but I think the issue ends up being that regardless if that has to happen for whatever reason, what is that ongoing connection? So are there other ways that we can actually get these kids connected? So it is the stuff around being able to, you know, Skype with one another. What kind of mechanisms can we do that? So if you do have somebody in Coos Bay and somebody in Baker, are there other things? There are a few activities that we're trying to do and trying to expand more of them. So one is, and I mentioned in some of the written material, Camp To Belong, which is an incredible support here for our young people. And we have two camps in the summer. This summer we'll have two different camps where the siblings get to come together for a camp for the week and do activities. And one of the activities ends up being a celebratory birthday party, because they're not always together on birthdays. So you do those kind of things. But it's a way of keeping kids together and then trying to build those connections if they don't already have them. So there's a variety of those activities that we need to get to the point where we're spreading them throughout the year. So it's not just the summertime thing that they're actually meeting with kids back and forth, but it is about trying to keep them together if at all possible. And if not, then what are we doing to keep them connected even if they're not living together?
Thank you. Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Great. You're welcome.
All right, is there anybody else that wants to be heard on House Bill 2216? Oh, can we put this on for a work session for Monday, please,
okay.
Matt?
Sure thing.
That would be great. All right, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2216A and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2344A. I'm noticing we've got this intergenerational divide on the two sides. We've got kids and youth on this side, seniors on the other side.
Should we integrate?
Madam Chair?
Chair, would you like me to read?
Yes, would you please do the summary? Right. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2344A modifies qualifications for minors to participate in independent living programs and modifies the activity requirements to include volunteer activities and permits exceptions. It permits DHS to pay grants for transportation expenses to enrolled persons.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, my name for the record is Rosemary Avendetti. I'm the Independent Living Program Coordinator for Department of Human Services Child Welfare, and I'm here to speak on behalf of House Bill 2344. So currently, the Oregon Revised Statute 418.475 allows the department to provide foster youth who are ages 16 through 20 and in the department's care and custody with funding to assist them with their monthly living expenses. The program is called the Independent Living Housing Subsidy Program. So youth who plan to access this subsidy program must be working with an independent living program provider who will assist the youth to increase their skills and abilities, such as money management, time management, household maintenance, and decision making. The current law and policy are very explicit on the types of productive activities a youth must maintain. So they must have either paid employment, education, or a combination of the two to equal full-time activity. And so what needs to change in the Oregon Revised Statute is that it was created in the mid-70s and really has not had any significant changes since. The statute needs to be updated to reflect current practices and realities of serving older teens and young adults preparing to transition to adulthood. Senate Bill 2344 would allow two important changes along with some minor technical changes as well. Again, in the late 70s, the department rarely served youth past the age of 18. And in the early 90s, the federal government also recognized the need to serve youth past the age of 18 in care and also to allow them to participate in supervised independent living settings. So Oregon was actually ahead of the federal government in that sense. So Senate Bill 2344 clarifies who may be served by replacing the word minor with unmarried person who's at least 16 years of age and not older than 20. So that's one major change for us. It would also expand the types of productive activities allowed to include volunteering. Volunteering allows young people to engage in non-paid internships, job shadows, or other types of non-paid activities in their communities. Foster youth may not always be allowed to work or may not have the ability to get to work, so transportation is often a barrier for our young people. Or if they do find a job, it's rare that they'll have full-time employment. So again, by having that additional option of volunteering, that helps to still allow them to get to full-time productive activity, but it may not be through education or employment. The goal will continue to be to move that young person towards full-time, either employment or education or the combination of the two. But again, to help them until they can get to that point, the volunteering would be a significant improvement. The House Bill, 2344-A, will also allow for exceptions. Currently, the statute does not allow any exceptions. So foster youth who access the subsidy program, so if they lose their job or maybe experience prolonged illness or medical leave, they're faced with being terminated from our subsidy program due to lack of compliance. While that may sound like a reasonable consequence, unfortunately, these young people have often signed a year lease of where they're staying, and so they can't just pick up and move, not without incurring a significant cost to break that lease. So by allowing a time-limited exception, or not allowing those time-limited exceptions, some youth face eviction or sometimes homelessness. So those are the reasons that we ask that you, for your support of Senate Bill 2344.
Thank you very much.
Hello again, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Alexis Baska. As a foster youth who has used the subsidy program, I think that this bill is amazing. I think that I'm 20 years old and I actively seek full-time employment, and it's hard, especially when I don't have a degree, things like that, factors that play in. So it's hard to sometimes come up with 40 hours of employment.
So I just think that this is a really great bill for foster youth everywhere. We sometimes have different challenges that come into play, and we can't call our parents and be like, hey, I'm going through this. It's kind of just us on our own. So I think that this would benefit especially older youth all over the state.
Fantastic. Are there any questions for Rosemary or Alexis?
I do, Madam Chair. So, Alexis, so what are your educational plans?
So I'm currently a political science major. I want to become the president someday.
Okay.
So,
excellent.
Yeah.
That's great. And so are you receiving a free tuition under the Foster Youth Promise?
So that is last dollar after financial aid. Mm-hmm. So since I'm not currently in school this term, but when I return in the fall, I'll be at a community college, so I won't need the tuition and fee waiver because I'll have covered by financial aid.
But you will transfer to a university,
yeah.
And then you will need it.
Yeah.
Great. We love that program, don't we?
Yes, we do. We do. And we like to make sure that people know that they get to
That's
use
right.
it, right? Right. Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you both very much.
Thank
Is
you.
There anybody else that would like to be heard on House Bill 2344? Why, nope. Can we also set this for a work session on Monday?
Okay.
All right. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2344 and open up a public hearing on HJM4.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Joint Memorial 4 urges Congress to pass the Raise Family Caregivers Act.
Great. And we've got John Bartholomew, Tara Stegner, and Sarah Kaufman. Welcome. And thank you also for being flexible with the change in time. And thank you all very much for coming.
Yeah. Thank you, Senator Gelser, members of the committee. For the record, I'm John Bartholomew, Government Relations Director for AARP Oregon. And Representative Kenny Geyer had intended to be here, but with the change in time, she was unable to join us. But she did want to send her regards and her strong support for HJM4. Her staff, Jen Corbridge, actually participated in the Oregon Family Caregiver Respite Work Group that I'll be talking about briefly. So HJM4 is a memorial. It honors two things, or it honors the hard work of family caregivers in Oregon. It just says that legislators will consider the recommendations of the Oregon Caregiver Respite Work Group that you should have a copy of that I submitted via OLIS last night. And it urges Congress to pass the Raise Family Caregivers Act, which would lead to the creation of a national strategy for family caregivers. So I'll speak briefly about the Raise Family Caregivers Act first. It has not yet been reintroduced in this new Congress, but in the 2015 Congress, it passed unanimously in the Senate by voice vote, and it just was never taken up by the House. And it does urge would lead to the creation of a national strategy to help family caregivers. This is something that doesn't exist now, but we know from the past that creating a strategy leads to good, positive changes. I worked on the creation of the National Alzheimer's Plan, and that has led to dramatic increases in funding for Alzheimer's research, and that has actually led to some great new findings from that research. And so we really hope that Congress will reintroduce this soon as a bipartisan piece of legislation and get it past the finish line. Now, family caregivers, I know many of us in this room are. I personally am a family caregiver. I know some of you up there, family caregivers. And really what a family caregiver is somebody who, you know, takes care of an adult loved one for whatever level. It can be the person that takes their grandmother to the grocery store once a week. It can be like me, where I drive my wife everywhere into doctor's appointments because of her MS. And it can be everything from bathing to medication management, et cetera. We have about 470,000 family caregivers in Oregon, and they really constitute the foundation of our long-term care system. Without them, many of these individuals that they care for would be in long-term care settings instead. In fact, the value of their care is about $5.7 billion a year in Oregon. But being a family caregiver leads to a lot of stress. That stress can be financial, physical, emotional. And that is why we set up the Oregon Caregiver Respite Work Group. We started this up last April, went around the state, did a number of town hall community meetings. I know Senator Canope, you attended the one that we had in Bend, to really find out what family caregivers need in terms of supports. Respite is one of the top things that we've heard time and time again is a need for family caregivers. And what respite is, I mean, part of the problem is the language. Respite. Would you like some respite care services? Or would you like a short break from caregiving? You know, that's all it really is a short break from caregiving that provides some relief from those intense demands of being a family caregiver. And people get it in a number of different ways. We have adult day programs, and Tara will talk about the one that she works with. Home care services provide respite. Some people will get respite through a short-term stay in a long-term care setting if there's a place that's available. But we know that respite reduces the stresses on family caregivers that often lead to higher health care costs. So, and one of the financial aspects is that most family caregivers pay for this out of pocket. Medicaid does provide some support for those who are Medicaid eligible. Long-term care insurance, if you have it, can pay for some, some policies will pay for respite. And then we have some state and federal programs. Oregon Project Independence is one way that people can get respite, although they do prioritize single individuals than families. But they do support some families, and the caregiver gets a break while the individual is getting some OPI services. And the Family Caregiver Support Program that is part of the Older Americans Act is the only program out there that is dedicated towards family caregivers. So, you have the report as testimony. I did just want to highlight a few of the key recommendations. There are 15 recommendations that we came up with. Some of it had funding requests, and we decided that because of the budgetary situation, we were not going to be asking for more money this session, although we are opposing any cuts to OPI. There was an issue about adult day centers and their and the rules associated with them, and already Oregon DHS is working on revising the rules for adult day programs, and so we're already moving forward on that. So we don't need any legislation there. In fact, this is the only legislation we came out with is this joint memorial. AARP has been working with the business community directly to talk about how can we support family caregivers in the workplace, because about 60% of family caregivers still work. And so we had a conference with Portland Business Journal back in March. It was originally February, then it was March.
Recently.
Yes, recently. which was attended by several hundred people, including many from the Portland area business community, to learn more about how they can support family caregivers in the workplace. And we're working with community colleges right now to explore this idea of having maybe an adult day center on campus where students can learn how to provide care, so that helps workforce development. You have a new option that's in the community. There's a lot of different things that particular proposal can help out with, and it seems to be picking up some steam. So HJM4 is really about honoring all those family caregivers, some of you, honoring their work, urging Congress to do their job in creating a strategy that will help all family caregivers across the United States, and that you'll take a close look at that respite work group report and see maybe there's some places that you and I can work directly together in your community to make things better for the family caregivers. So thank you, and I'll pass it off to Tara.
Thank you. Welcome, Tara.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Gelser and members of the committee. My name is Tara Stegner, and I'm one of the co-directors of Grace Center for Adult Day Services in Corvallis. I've submitted a written testimony in support of HJM4, and I'd like to point out some highlights from my letter and make some additional comments. First, like John mentioned, I always like to mention and point out the fact that caregiving touches all of us. I'm confident that nearly 100% or close to it in any room I walk into, no matter the size, individuals in that room are either themselves a caregiver, have been a caregiver, or personally know a caregiver. When we sit and think about it, we realize the level of need and how close it is to each of us. And I want to just briefly mention my journey into the work that I'm doing. I transferred to Oregon State University to study gerontology because I knew that I wanted to take my career to places where it would benefit older adults, but what that looked like, I wasn't sure. And it was through my studies that I encountered Grace Center and conducted an internship there and realized what adult day services were and respite services, and that immediately became my passion and my direction, and I truly believe it's going to be the future of long-term care as a sustainable option for people. So I'd like to talk and tell you more about Grace Center. We represent one of just under 20 adult day centers in the state of Oregon, and Grace Center is one of the more advanced day centers providing both health and social services at our 11,000 square foot facility in Corvallis. And so what day centers are, it's a place for both older adults and people with disabilities of any age, 18 and up, to come and provide and receive services, whether that's going to be social-based, so we have therapeutic activities going at our center, but also there's going to be health services like a nurse on staff, health monitoring. We provide direct care all the way up through all activities of daily living, including toileting, dressing, showering, things like that. And so the individuals coming to our center are actually quite diverse. Our youngest participant at our center and many adult day centers across the state is actually, at this time, we have a participant in his 20s, and our oldest is 101. So we have a very diverse group of people coming, whether that's because they have a cognitive decline or a physical decline. But the one common denominator amongst all our participants is they can't be home alone anymore. Due to one or both of those declines. So the vast majority of our participants, and we serve anywhere between 60 and 100 at this time, are coming from a home setting. So they still live in their homes, and it's a family member who stepped up to the plate and is providing care for them, be it a spouse, an adult child, or some other family member or friend who's chosen to help them with the care needs that they have so that they can stay in their own home. So when everyone that attends Grace Center is at our center, they're participating in activities that are helping them integrate into the community to have opportunities to hopefully avoid any unnecessary physical or cognitive declines. But for every one participant you see in our program, there's at least one unseen recipient out there in the community getting that respite that they need. And respite can look a lot of different things for different people. As I mentioned, we have a lot of individuals caring for their parents, and they themselves are still active in the workforce. And all of a sudden, because their parent has now had a stroke or a diagnosis of dementia and they have moved in with them, they're faced with, do I care for mom or dad at home and quit my job? Or do I go ahead and move forward with some long-term care placement, even though that's not necessarily our wishes at this time? So we have so many caregivers coming to us thanking us that they have the opportunity to continue to work and have peace of mind while their loved one's at our center. Other respite opportunities look like individuals taking naps. We have a lot of folks who are caring for someone who's up at all hours. A lot of individuals with dementia, their sleep cycle is disturbed and they're up at all hours. So especially our elderly caregivers, this is very taxing on them. So they come to us just so excited to know that their loved one's in a wonderful environment and they get to go home and take a nap or do their taxes or go grocery shopping or clean the house or see their friends or get to volunteer. So it looks a lot of different ways, but it's very vital. And I think, as my stories highlight in my written testimony, respite services have some very valuable components to it. It's going to support a productive workforce. Like I mentioned, individuals are able to stay at their jobs and be able to focus at their work and not be concerned about their family member. It decreases healthcare costs. It's a well-known statistic that health that caregivers' health declines more rapidly than the care receiver often, because they're doing what is basically a 24/7 job, and if they don't have access to respite, it's often their health that actually starts to decline quicker than the individual needing the care. It saves the state and consumers money. Specifically, day services is half as much as in-home care, and it's a quarter or even less than residential, obviously, which would be 24/7. Grace Center itself is open Monday through Friday from 7:30 till 5:30, and one Saturday a month, and a lot of day centers are doing weekends as well as full work days. It keeps families together and our communities intergenerational. That's my personal passion. I really believe in the fact that with day services and respite services, we can keep especially our older adults in home settings for as long as they desire, and thereby keep our communities intergenerational. I think that that should be an opportunity that everyone should have access to, and I think it does a benefit to our communities when seniors aren't always and automatically in separate communities and living facilities. Of course, there is so much more work to be done. As I mentioned, there's 20 or fewer adult day centers in the state of Oregon, and there's only one adult day center east of the Cascades at this time. And limited funding, as John mentioned, is an issue. And also education. I mentioned in my letter that although we serve quite a large area, Tri-County area, Lynn, Benton, and Polk counties, as my job as Director of Community Relations, I find that still, even after much effort on my part, there's many people that don't know that adult day service is an option or even what respite is. So many caregivers feel alone and isolated in their caregiving role, and they need to know that there's options for them. And just to do some brief highlights from the stories that I've shared, I like to highlight a couple different caregiving situations. One is Dave and Carol. We served them for several years, and Carol was an individual who had early onset Alzheimer's at age 67. And Dave's desire was to have his wife home with him for as long as possible, but he himself had to have open heart surgery and realized that he wasn't going to be able to do that alone, and he needed respite services. And so when he was able to bring Carol to our center and receive respite through our day services, he was able to avoid premature nursing home placement, which oftentimes, especially with Alzheimer's or forms of dementia, if the individual is only in their mid-stage with that disease, a transition into a long-term care setting can be actually quite traumatic and very disturbing to them. And we often are able then at day centers to provide a smooth transition, as I mentioned in my next story about Colleen, Marilyn, and Herb, and the fact that they often can get that peace of mind of being able to go home at the end of the day, but get used to being in that group setting. So when the time comes that it is an appropriate time to have them move into memory care, they actually have quite a smoother transition, and family is emotionally and financially prepared for that. And just pointing out that, you know, as the admissions coordinator, I watch many families come in and they look very tired. They look stressed. They have bags under their eyes. They are exhausted. And I've watched the transformation of many a caregiver as they continue to bring their loved one to our center, that over time they appear more energetic. They appear happier. They have smiles on their faces. They're telling jokes. And they clearly have had an actual physical transformation by just receiving a little bit of respite a couple days a week. And just last, a quote from an individual who wrote an article in our local paper that our services and the respite he received was allowed him to keep his wife at home for two more precious years. And I think you can't put a value on that when it's your family, it's your spouse, and people want to be able to live at their own home for as long as they can. It's very important. So highlights is really just, like I mentioned, respite enables people to go to work. It enables people's mood and health to be improved. It helps people have hobbies and relationships restored. And ultimately, it makes for better caregiving by helping people avoid caregiver burnout. And when people choose to be a family caregiver, it's because they care about that person. But if they don't get respite, they're often experiencing stress, and that relationship can actually be put under strain. And so it helps that individual have a better relationship with the care receiver, which is their heart and intent in that caregiving role. So thank you so much for...
Thank you so much, Tara. Welcome.
Senator Gelser, members of the committee, my name is Sarah Kaufman, and I work for the Alzheimer's Association. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today in support of HJM4. I'd also like to thank John Bartholomew and AARP for their leadership in convening the Oregon Respite Care Work Group. The Alzheimer's Association was part of that dynamic group of partners, and we enjoyed looking for innovative and thoughtful solutions to more respite in our state. So today, I want to specifically address caregiving as it relates to Alzheimer's disease and other dementias. With Alzheimer's disease, it's not just the people living with the disease who really struggle, but it's also their caregivers. And that is a job that usually falls on families and friends. So, and we have more than 5 million Americans living with this disease right now. And in Oregon alone, we have about 63,000 people living with Alzheimer's disease that are 65 and older. And for caregivers, specifically in Oregon last year, there were an estimated 181,000 family caregivers, and all of those are unpaid caregivers, and that breaks down. They actually provide more than 200 million hours of unpaid care, and that's a contribution to the state of Oregon of about $2.6 billion in terms of care. Care for people with Alzheimer's disease can be wide-ranging and, in many instances, all-encompassing. It's intrusive, and it can be very, very personal. For many, the demands of caregiving can cause a decline in their health, and it can aggravate existing health conditions as well. Evidence has suggested that the stress of dementia care can increase caregiver susceptibility to disease and other health complications. Further, the longer a caregiver has been providing care, the more likely they are to report poor health as an individual. And nearly 40% of family caregivers of people with Alzheimer's report symptoms of depression. Caregiving is demanding, and caregivers need a break, not only for their own personal health, but for the health of the person receiving the care, as Tara pointed out and as John pointed out. Respite care provides the caregiver with a short break to take care of their own needs, whether it's washing their hair, or cleaning the house, or just taking a nap. When caregivers have access to respite care, they can take care of errands and household chores, and they can relax from the pressures of everyday caregiving. There's a growing body of research that suggests supportive services for family caregivers, including education and skills training. It can improve the well-being and quality of life for not just the caregiver, but for also the care recipient. And other studies have measured the effects of respite services on recipients' well-being and quality of life. So as I close, I think greater awareness is needed regarding existing interventions, as well as new solutions that might be needed to ensure caregivers can continue to provide the valued care without risking their own health and the quality of life of not only themselves but also their care receiver or their care recipient. Expanding and increasing respite options in the state of Oregon is one way to address this issue and offer greater support to the thousands of family caregivers. And I have a quote. One small quote I'd like to share. We have a couple wonderful volunteers today. We have about 60 advocates here today for Alzheimer's Advocacy Day. Some of them have already met with your offices, so thank you for sharing that time with them. But one of the advocates that we have here today, when she talks about respite, she says, it's just to have some time to not make decisions, to just be silent, and to not be needed, and just to remember who I am. Respite is something essential for me. So, in closing, I ask that you support House Joint Resolution, House Joint Resolution Memorial 4 that recognizes Oregon family caregivers. It appreciates the work and the recommendations of the Oregon Respite Care Work Group. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very, very much. Are there any questions for this panel?
No, but a comment.
Yeah,
when I was campaigning this summer, I knocked on a door, and a woman came and started talking to me and saying she was taking care of her mother. And then she just burst into tears. She says, I can't do this anymore. I need some help. And so, I mean, it was just such a tragic situation for her, living in a small, she was in an apartment duplex. It was all ground level. And so this is such a need in our community. I just had to share that story because it just shows that we have to do something in our communities. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Senator Dimbro.
Yeah, Senator Monica Anderson and I were the legislators on the SPADO, the state plan for Alzheimer's. And I remember those meetings and, you know, at that, I know there was a lot of talk leading to the state plan about the need for respite. We heard from a lot of people about that. And I'm sure the problem is worse now than it was when we did that plan. So I think sending this message to Washington is very important. I do have a question, John. You mentioned plans potentially in the works for community colleges to have centers, and I find that very exciting. I know that PCC is looking into that. Do you know how that's going?
Chair Gelser, Senator Dembro, I'm working with Jan Abhishekra at PCC and Yvonne Smith at Clackamas Community College jointly. They're sending, we crafted a letter together to all the community colleges that I don't know that it's gone out just yet, or it might have just gone out. Jan is taking care of that. But it's to try to get the ball rolling with all the community colleges to see who all is interested in this topic, because then we plan on having some kind of a get-together in the fall with all the interested stakeholders to talk about how this could look. This idea came out of the community meeting we did in Roseburg, and somebody noted, well, we've got Umpqua Community College right up the road. They're doing allied health programs, and there's a lot of need in this community. Why couldn't they open up an adult day program on campus? Then you get students learning how to provide care. Students who are family caregivers can actually bring their loved ones to campus, mm-hmm. For discount or free. We end up having a stronger workforce. They get the skills that they need to learn, and it provides a new resource in the community that would likely be lower cost because it's staffed by students. And everybody was like, yeah, that's a good idea. And it's just something that hasn't really been thought of that much, but it's already being done for childcare.
Right.
So knowing that we also need to increase the workforce for long-term care in general, getting people some training at that community college level is a great idea. So all of these things take some time. I mean, if they're going to open up something on campus, I would imagine that they might have to include it in their next bond proposal or something like that. So it takes a little time, but we're working on trying to find out who's interested, and we already have two community colleges interested.
That's great. It seems like a no-brainer to me, yeah. Really.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Well, and I just wanted to, in my district, Grace Center, which actually started in my church, and there's a preschool in the church, not related to the church or to Grace Center, but when my kids were little, there was this great collaboration between the preschool and Grace Center and just some really great intergenerational activities that I know my kids have very fond memories of, and it was just such a great program and amazing to see how it's grown from a very tiny program to a pretty substantial organization. So congratulations on all that great work.
Yeah.
All right. Is there anybody else that would like to be heard on HJM4? Seeing none, thank you very much. Let's schedule this for a work session on Monday as well.
Okay.
Colleagues, we don't have a lot of bills yet that have come from the House. We have a couple of big bills that may take some time. So we're going to do our best to work through the less time-consuming ones first and save time later on in our second half of the session to tackle some of the more lively ones. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on HJM4. And anything else for the good of the order from anyone? Sorry
Thank
to
you.
Give you free time again.
We're not sorry.
You're not.
We're not sorry.
You're not.